the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Andrew Kolin. Andrew is professor of political science at Hilbert College. His books include State Power and Democracy, State Structure and Genocide, and State Power... Oh, I put that one down twice. I'm going to have to take that out. Well, there must be another book in there, Andrew, and if there is, I'll let you update me on it. Anyway, I welcome you on the program. It's great to have you back. Is there a new book?
I am starting, in fact, that you mentioned that over the summer. It's kind of growing out of my previous book, as you know, which I've discussed on your program before, the book on state power, which now I talk about police state practices as not just growing after the American Revolution, just in terms of the concentration of power in the state related to expansionism. But I look at the workplace, and I focus more on issues of class and how the workplace came developed alongside the state as basically two institutions over the course of American history that are undemocratic. So that might be a year or two before it comes out, but I certainly would like to be on your program again to talk about that.
You have a date. I absolutely guarantee you. When the book is ready or close to it, Andrew, you are absolutely welcome to come on and discuss it.
Sure. Yeah, what I'd like to discuss with you today is I thought, which would be kind of timely and relevant given the recent inauguration of President Obama, and in particular his State of the Union address, that I thought it would be of interest to your listeners to have a discussion of what to expect in Obama's second term. And I found that his State of the Union provides what I would call some of the rhetorical clues. And of course, as you kind of look at one overall theme in the address from start to finish, Obama kind of went out of his way to give us again that he's the advocate of quote-unquote change you could believe in. Except when you start to look closely at what is behind his high-sounding change rhetoric in the address, I argue, and I'll make reference to the quotes and show you what's really behind the quotes, that Obama, again, is there serving the interests of a small political and economic elite. Now, let me get to the particular comments that he made in the State of the Union address. Now, again, you see the populist rhetoric. And again, I'll start with this initial quote where he says, and I'm quoting him directly. I made sure I took all this down so your viewers could hear his quotes verbatim. He says his first quote, "I urge Congress to get together to pursue a bipartisan market-based solution to climate change," end of quote. Now, again, with this quote and so many others, I feel they are in need of some political translation. And the translation, as I see it, is that once again, like in the past, in his previous term, environmental policy will be profit-driven, and that the current policy of tax breaks, oil depletion allowances will continue, as well as the emergence, now on a grander scale nationally, of new sources of climate change in the form of fracking, you know, the extraction of gas in a kind of very dangerous way. Now, as you see, Obama continues upon this supposed environmentalist theme. He says again, and this to me was most disturbing, and here he's referring to the gas fracking thing. This is once again a direct quote. He says, "The natural gas boom had led to cleaner power and greater energy independence." This is quite astounding, especially if you were to get in any of the particulars. But in general terms, Obama seems to come across as this pioneering environmentalist of a new source, but yet he's continuing to, be in support of old fossil fuels, which have been dramatically increasing climatic change. Now, also in light of this, he says, and again, a direct quote, he said, "That's why my administration will keep cutting red tape and speeding up new oil and gas permits." Again, the old addictions continue, meaning that fossil fuel will continue as the dominant energy source. Hardly, as far as I am concerned, change you could believe in. And now he also went on to say, which I found incredibly hypocritical considering the preceding comments, and this one I'll just read one particular sentence, where he says, "We must do more to combat climate change. Well, how can one expect to combat climate change when his policies are the same as they have been? And now if you look at, again, other aspects of which was a broad coverage of a number of issues in his State of the Union. Now he, again, I'm just picking this out of another area. It was in the foreign policy area. And here I want to quote directly. It's a one-sentence quote. He says, I quote, "After a decade of grinding war, our brave men and women in uniform are coming home." Except, again, when you look behind this kind of high-sounding rhetoric of Obama now being the peacemaker, the U.S. will maintain a minimum of 32,000 troops in Afghanistan until the very minimum of 2014. This is according to a number of Pentagon sources. And, of course, you can expect, which has been the current U.S. policy during and even prior to this administration, that there will be military bases and troops nearby. And again, as we see, as some troops have been departing from Afghanistan, Obama is shifting them elsewhere, which is kind of like, you know, the bait and switch of his troop deployments. And where are they going? They're going to the Pacific Rim. They're going to other parts in Asia. They're going to other parts in Africa. So it's not an actual wholesale bringing home of troops, but kind of a checkerboard, you know, shifting them around the board. Okay, and again, he's not telling this to his captive audience. While at the same time, he can say, we don't need to send tens of thousands of our sons and daughters abroad to occupy other nations. But that's precisely been the rhetoric. And he goes on to talk about that we need to help countries like Yemen, Libya, Somalia, provide them with their own security and to take the fight to terror. So this has been his justification to expand U.S. military presence globally to not only to supplement troops with and military bases with drones, which I want to get to in a moment, which was in another part of his speech. But here we have this ongoing and highly regrettable and certainly dysfunctional, certainly economic to the domestic economy of permanent war. And what Obama has accelerated, which is, I never thought I would find myself saying this, being the critic I was of the previous Bush administration, but in some particular areas, Obama has gone much further than his predecessor Bush, certainly in the area of national security, and in particular his now unfolding massive deployment of drones, which his administration has been what I would call sugarcoating. Now, what I thought should be brought to the attention of your listeners, which was totally omitted and quite troubling in the Obama State of the Union address, was the omission of the very important leak of the Justice Department white paper. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it.
Oh, I wrote about it, Andrew. I wrote about it. I wrote about Obama's State of the Union message before he gave it, after he gave it. I agree with every single thing you've been saying up to now. I doubt that I will disagree with anything you're going to say going forward. But there's no question that Obama, well, I think of Obama as a Nixon go to China moment. He literally has exceeded the worst of George Bush, just the way Nixon did what Democrats couldn't do, and Obama has done. He's exceeded what no Republican can do. And you always have to separate rhetoric from policy. I keep repeating that over and over again. Obama says one thing, he sugarcoats it. Forget his lips. Don't watch the move. Follow the policy making. That's where the rubber meets the road.
Exactly. And it is interesting that even establishment columnists in the New York Times, I believe it was the week or two ago, it was in the February Sunday edition, there was a very interesting article by Peter Baker, I believe, and he discusses what we are both concurring on is the continuity of Obama to the Bush administration's counterterrorism policies. Mr. Baker wrote something to the effect that now Obama in his second term with, and again I'm paraphrasing, with 4 years behind his tenure, that he was supposed to be the one-time critic of President Bush, finds himself now, and this I do remember, it's more or less somewhat of an exact quote, cast as the present-day Bush. Now, Baker goes on to say that, in a sense, that Obama is now even more militarily macho than his predecessor, all, again, in the name of fighting a war on terrorism and in the name of this dubious concept employed not just by Obama, but of so many other presidents, of national security.
Indeed.
Now, if you look, if you look at other areas of his... address to Congress, there are other some disturbing elements which I would not like to go under the radar, which I think your listeners should hear about. And that is, of course, the, as I made mention of before, and I want to discuss in a bit more detail, and that is the extensive use of drones, not just their enormous, how do you say, growth, but their targeting, which is kind of what I would call the new normal for this administration in general, is the killing of U.S. citizens. Whatever we may say about any of the supposed activities of al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son, they were simply assassinated. And I think this is an uncomfortable word that the administration does not want to go near. But these drone programs is essentially an assassination program, highly secretive, that can essentially target, which is quite radical, not just citizens outside the country, but as it proliferates with FAA approval, even U.S. citizens now are not just being spied upon, but can be targeted for execution. So, again, as I've discussed on more than one occasion on your program, these are, as I have defined, standard police state practices where, in the name of security, the president, acting on behalf of the executive branch, exercises absolute power. There's no legal restraint on this. There's no questioning it. It comes down to how dictators have behaved. Just trust me, I am in charge, and you dare not question because I control, you know, the use of force and violence. And this is especially acute as Obama has made his credentials towards the end of his first term, and I believe even more bellicose in his second term, in the area of national security. Now, consider another example of this. If you look at the recent congressional hearings regarding the confirmation of what is now to be the new head of the CIA, John Brennan, interesting case there. John Brennan had played a prominent role in the development of the drone program, and he has had a very close, I would even call it friendship, with President Obama. But what, of course, did not come up in his confirmation hearings was that it's open season now as far as the U.S. government is concerned to kill U.S. citizens, which, of course, is nowhere talked about by any of this so-called questioning at his CIA hearing. But Brennan did say a couple of interesting things, and some that he did not say. What he did not say is that he would not go on record to state that waterboarding is a form of torture. And again, to bring to the attention of your listeners, when the state has assumed absolute power and it feels there is no restraint on it, torture is a result. And Obama, in spite of his high-sounding rhetoric, torture is still a practice now going under the radar and practiced by the CIA and any number of black sites. What is also interesting about Brennan is that he didn't admit that he made any effort at all to stop waterboarding. And this is while he was a top CIA official during the Bush administration. So he's well on board, and he's certainly able, once he gets his rubber stamp confirmation, to continue the insidious and under-the-radar practices of torture. Now, let's get back again to Obama and his State of the Union address. And again, I would urge your listeners, as I'm sure you do, to treat whatever any president, this is not just picking on a Democrat, but Republicans as well, whenever there is what I call abstract, high-sounding rhetoric. And this is prominent in a couple of remarks, which sound like what I call feel-good remarks, but are quite troubling remarks. And this One I want to mention, I want to state, it's a couple lines here. He says, we must enlist our values in the fight. That's why my administration has worked tirelessly to forge a durable legal, that's the key word there, legal and policy framework to guide our counterterrorism efforts. Throughout, we have kept Congress fully informed of our efforts. On both aspects, the legal and the fully informed Congress are, I have no problem saying this, just out and out lies. There is no legal framework behind the counterterrorism efforts. The Patriot Act and other so-called documents would not stand the scrutiny if you compare to what's stated in any number of international agreements, the torture conventions, regarding the use of torture, etc. Now, in relation to that, look at, as I've already mentioned, I want to get back to this interesting aspect of what the Obama administration is doing with drones. The use of the drones, there is no semblance of any durable legal framework. There's nothing governing the use and possible limits of such a program. And if you, again, look closely, which I would urge the listeners to do so, try to find, which one can find without looking too much, what the so-called justification is for use. And what you do find there is this extremely abstract reference to what is referred to as imminent threat. Now, this is highly dubious. It's pretty much whatever the administration could say is a quote-unquote imminent threat. Also, the Obama administration does not require evidence of a threat, and that to me is quite troubling. So, again, these are all ways the administration can simply say we need to use these weapons overseas, but underlying that is, yes, we need to use these weapons overseas to terrorize, to, in a way, engage war over national borders without any formal declaration of war. And again, this is in violation of, I could cite chapter and verse, any number of international agreements. Now, furthermore, if you were to look again within any of the so-called justifications, you'll find a reference to what is called, quote-unquote, continuing threat. And that translates into whatever the United States wants to do to impose itself by force. And that, sadly, has included, which I'm sure you're aware of, the administration has downplayed, the enormous and accelerating number of civilian deaths by these drones. And they've been the chief targets, okay? Now, what I'm suggesting to your listeners is that there is a what I would call a willful expression of unlimited absolute power exercised by this national security state, which is engaging in police state practices for just the reason that there is no judicial review on the use of these drones. And again, I must repeat myself, being the critic that I have been of the Bush administration, particularly in my last book, the Obama administration, in this sense, has gone way beyond the Bush administration in terms of its police state practices. And in this fundamental regard, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, stock and trade of one of the Bush administration police state practices was preventive detention, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, the black sites, in which the government simply says we're going to seize you and detain you and there is no judicial process involved. Now, the Obama administration has really simplified things, if I may use that in a non-complimentary way. It does not seek to detain. It simply kills. It kills the so-called enemies of the states through the use of drones.
And now, if I could add one thing on drones.
Oh, sure, please.
In a legitimate war of self-defense, you could say drones are a legitimate weapon. Well, America hasn't fought a legitimate war of self-defense since World War II ended. You could call that not entirely legitimate, certainly the most legitimate one that America last fought. Every single war America has fought since World War II has been a lawless war of aggression. So all weapons used in those wars are illegal weapons. America today uses drones in non-war zones, non-official war zones in Yemen, in Somalia. It uses them wherever it wishes to. They'll be used in America. I wrote about plans to put eyes in the sky spying on Americans. And John Brennan does not rule out the possibility of using drones or, I guess, anything else to kill Americans on U.S. territory. I mean, if America wants to kill them, they're a legitimate target. Well, of course, these are all lawless acts. As far as the way drones are used in Afghanistan or any place else, I've written about a study, I've mentioned it on this program, conducted by New York University and Stanford, that said only 2% of targets killed were high-value ones. What they're really saying is 98% of them are basically innocent civilians, at least most of them. That's what the study said. Two prominent universities. I mean, this is lawless stuff, Andrew. America literally gets away with murder. Nobody talks about this. The Congress doesn't hold Brennan or anybody else accountable. The U.S. media don't hold them accountable. And this stuff just goes on and on and on. The next step is to kill Americans in U.S. soil.
Yes, and again, this is the... Yes, this is the extension of absolute power that this government can employ using the drones, which amounts to, as you correctly said, a war against civilians. And again, the primary casualties have been men, women, unarmed men, women, and children. And I find this kind of poo-pooing of it a kind of what I would call a double standard, that somehow non-American lives are not as valued, but... And again, I think in its own kind of perverse way, the roosters are coming home to roost, and that even now American lives are even no longer being valued, that, as you correctly stated, the drones are being increasingly used to engage in surveillance and then possible target of U.S. citizens. But what I would return to the theme which we had discussed on your previous programs, we have to ask ourselves, try to answer, what is the ultimate purpose of the use of drones, this long-term permanent war, and that is to, first of all, attack democracy overseas, to attack those who would dare question U.S. economic and foreign policy. It's to silence dissent, and the way they are seeking to do it in the most efficient manner, violently, is to now employ technology. It's rather shameful. It's rather shameful. But at the same time, it's also supposedly, and I've yet to believe that this will work in the long term, it's part of what has been often referred to as a flexible response, that somehow troops can be more mobile to send to different places without a labor-intensive commitment, that now it's being supplemented with technology. A shameful policy, a very shameful policy.
It really is. And as far as the drones go, operators can kill people in Yemen operating from the suburbs of Las Vegas, Andrew. I mean, they can be anywhere in the world. They can be close by. They can be far away. They operate multiple computer screens and keyboards. And now the Pentagon, and I wrote about this, the Pentagon will give medals for murder to drone operators. They'll rank above the Bronze Star combat medal, below the Silver Star. Imagine giving medals for murder. Official policy.
I've heard of that. Yes, it's a shameful new practice. But I also, again, wonder, when you think of the extensive use of drones, whether eventually, which I believe it will backfire, that what we're starting to see, which the corporate media won't cover this all that much for obvious reasons, is that these drone operators are starting to experience their own psychological difficulties, and that they are starting to come to grips with what they're doing, even though it seems like a video game remote control, that they are actually killing people overseas. And we're seeing some in small numbers who are resisting being a part of this process, which I find the reason to be a little hopeful. Cautiously hopeful.
Well, I hope so, Andrew. It really shocks me that anybody would be willing to take a job and kill people. I mean, they know that targeting is very imperfect. I mean, if I can read stuff that says 98% of the ones killed are not really the ones they're going after, they have to know something about this. A lot of these people operate these things. They probably communicate with each other. They don't have to be in the same place. They can do it by email. I mean, there may be some kind of a network among these operators. So they've got to know something. You would think this would wear on them after a time. And I think to myself, how can anybody get out of bed in the morning and go to work to kill? Your job is to kill. What kind of a job is that?
It's rather shameful, but you see, it is the outgrowth of other Obama policies. If you again go back to his State of the Union address, I found it, of course, very curious with all Obama's high-sounding patriotic rhetoric, and that America is simply doing what's best, in a patronizing way, to make the world a better place. He failed to mention that while he was giving his State of the Union address and making these kind of remarks, there's a lawsuit that was filed in the Second Circuit U.S. Courthouse in Manhattan, New York. And the lawsuit filed by Chris Hedges, former Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times, is essentially a lawsuit against Obama for signing into law the NDAA, which we've discussed in your program previously, the National Defense Authorization Act. And the gist of the suit, it raises what is the troubling aspects of course, a particular section, Section 1021, which I would urge your listeners to Google and look for. Section 1021, especially Section B2, I believe it is. And this section essentially permits the military to detain anyone, including U.S. citizens, who, again, I'm paraphrasing from what's in the section, who substantially support al-Qaeda or associated forces. But again, when this section refers to al-Qaeda and associated forces, these terms are rather general and lack, of course, specificity as to what exactly is al-Qaeda, what exactly is associated forces. But this is, again, what I've mentioned on more than one occasion as we discussed in your program. This is assaulting dissent. Essentially, if you go back in time, not just from the current, what I call, obsession with terrorism globally, it used to be communism, but now in the name of first communism and now terrorism, it's a way to silence all voices. It's simply a way you label a viewpoint that is dissenting or takes issue with the government, and that is a way to enact such extraordinary measures like Section 21 or the provisions of the Patriot Act. Now, what I find certainly very troubling is that under the provisions of 1021, essentially, if the government identifies you, that is it. Due process is suspended, and the same holds true if you are identified under various provisions of the Patriot Act. What it translates into is that you are detained without counsel, without any semblance of due process, and most of all, I want to, again, emphasize to your listeners that U.S. and non-U.S. citizens can be imprisoned indefinitely. And this is by the military.
In a military prison, exactly. And they can either stay there charged or uncharged. And if they go on trial, it'll be in a military tribunal that has no basis whatsoever, either in international, certainly not in U.S. law. A private citizen should only go on trial in a civil law, given habeas rights, due process, the whole thing, Andrew, and they lose all of these rights.
Yes, and exactly what it amounts to is they are treating civilians as if they're armed combatants against the government, which is astounding, which is an astounding concept, no matter how you take it, legally or non-legally, that civilians are treated in a way that should not be in accordance with civilian law, that they have to go through a criminal proceeding. But I find certainly of equal troubling aspect of this, if you look again at the NDAA of, again, 1021, but Section C4, and again, I paraphrase, and according to that section, anyone can be sent to any foreign country or any entity, it's essentially what it means is that the U.S. can simply grab you, snatch you. No one knows your whereabouts. You have no access to an attorney.
Absolutely. Andrew, let's take a short break.
Sure.
The music tells me to pause, and there'll be a few announcements made, and we'll come right back. Hold your thought, and we'll come right back to what you were talking about.
You're listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back. I'm on with Andrew Cohen. We're talking about Obama's State of the Union message, the various laws that are on the books, the police state laws. There's no other way to describe them than that. Oppressive laws targeting free expression, targeting people who have a right to say what they believe, follow the, as long as they don't break the law, they should, according to U.S. law, constitutional law, be able to say or do anything that they wish. If you break these laws, it's another story. Well, Obama, the Congress, they make it up as they go along. They put these oppressive laws on the books. America is getting awfully close to tyranny, Andrew. It is a real situation. We certainly discuss it on this program. Let me let you pick up from where you left off.
Sure. As we were discussing prior to the break, I wanted to bring to the attention of your listeners, which I'm sure probably your audience is a very informed audience, but the omission, conveniently, in Obama's State of the Union address of such things as the NDAA and some of the heinous sections, as we've been discussing, of 1021. But again, as we had been now talking just prior to the break, if you look at Section C4, it allows for the government to do something unprecedented, which once again this administration has superseded what the previous Bush administration has done. That's in Section C4, which allows for anyone to be sent to any foreign country or entity, and that's kind of really a blank check to torture. So we are exporting any person or persons to go elsewhere. And for the authoritarian regimes, which the U.S. frequently has alliances with, for torture. So extraordinary rendition now is a normal part of state policy. Now, again, I want to emphasize that this is how the government deals with any, individuals or organizations that seem to be making a nuisance of themselves or seems to be very public or visible. And if you look at what authoritarian regimes have typically done, and to me this takes us to this Section C4, is you have to understand that you don't have to oppress everyone. You can't deport, for obvious reasons, millions of people out of the country. All you have to do is make examples of a few people as a way to intimidate and scare. And that's what this does. This is a way to intimidate and to make people have second thoughts about protesting or questioning the government or being out there or being visible. So, of course, this is one of the many, what I call, omissions from Obama's State of the Union address. And I want to, again, for discussion and to the attention of your listeners, another important omission in the Obama State of the Union was how far this administration has gone in enhancing what I call obsessive secrecy that would allow for an NDAA, would allow for drones, and would allow for permanent wars to be so ongoing. But if you, and this is, again, a step ahead of the previous administration, consider, too, for example, the real dramatic upturn in prosecution of whistleblowers, which one would have thought would have been quite prevalent in the Bush administration, but there wasn't many. But certainly Obama must have learned something from his predecessor, something of, for instance, those who in very courageous fashion came forward and exposed the abuse of people interned in Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. So Obama took the Obama administration has taken a very more aggressive turn. In particular, if you focus on one, Bradley Manning, who had been held for so long in conditions of extreme isolation, and who really, if you look at the particulars, which we don't have time to do on your program, but in essence, he released documents which reveals the underlying extent to which this government has conducting all kinds of clandestine wars and illegal wars, kind of reminiscent, and I feel even more dramatic than the previous Daniel Ellsberg releases in the Pentagon Papers, which, by the way, Ellsberg has nothing but praise for the courage of Bradley Manning. Now, also, of course, the behind-the-scenes persecution of WikiLeaks' Julian Assange. Okay, so this administration has a pretty clear record from the first and now well into the second term of an ongoing obsession with hiding the ultimate purposes of what this administration is doing. Now, I wish that was all I could say and bring to the attention of your listeners, but that is not all. There is some other remarks which certainly disturbing about where this administration might go. Again, the difference between Obama appearing as the populist, that's the rhetoric, but what he actually does, and that's how you have to judge him, or any politician for that matter. But what you see in his State of the Union address is what he has to say about Medicare, which I believe should be important to all Americans, not just those who are older. It's kind of an attitude about the small social welfare state that we do have. And again, I want to quote Obama and say a little bit about the meaning of this particular quote where he makes reference to Medicare. He says, and I quote, "On Medicare, I'm prepared to enact reform that will achieve the same amount of health care savings by the beginning of the next decade as the reforms proposed by the bipartisan Simpson-Bowles Commission." Now, that is key, and that may have gone under the radar, this reference to Simpson-Bowles. Now, the Simpson-Bowles Commission, which he made no clear reference to the particulars of what they said, was a bipartisan Democrat-Republican commission to really map out what should be done with Medicare. But what came out of the commission, which Obama would have certainly been uncomfortable to tell truthfully to the audience, the commission recommended what I would call a number of draconian measures which dramatically impact on Medicare. And there are essentially four implications of what the Simpson-Bowles Commission released, which Obama is embracing. First is that what the commission has recommended is to increase Medicaid copays, which seems to be about to happen. That's my impression. Second, there are going to be cuts to Medicare Advantage and home health care programs, which certain seniors and others need. Third, what the Simpson-Bowles Commission outlined was the need to create what they refer to as a cap for Medicaid, Medicare growth, meaning that they want to cut down on increases in spending. And as a result, you get the fourth implication. So it's going to be a program that's not going to grow, that's going to face serious cutbacks along with, in support of the program, an increase in premiums. That's coming. That's coming.
Andrew, can I add one thing?
Sure.
I wrote about this. I've written about it a number of times. In 2009, I wrote about it when it happened, and I repeated it in a recent article. I quoted what Obama said about Medicare in 2009. Basically what he's saying now, he lied. The program is unsustainable and all of that rubbish, and we need to make major cuts and so on and so forth and so on. I think he gave an interview to the Washington Post. It was months after he took office. So he began this campaign against Medicare. Social Security will be next. Medicaid is part of the whole package. It began in 2009. Simpson-Bowles followed. 2010. 2010, I guess it was, and the policies that they came up with, he endorses Simpson, an extremist right-wing Republican, Bowles, a nominal Democrat, but really endorses the same kind of horrendous thing. They don't worry about this stuff. I mean, these people are millionaires, multimillionaires. They don't worry about Medicare or Social Security. They only want ordinary people to pay the price. Take it away from them so there's more money for war-making, there's more money for corporate handouts, the usual kind of stuff. And anybody who complains, you got the police state laws on the books to target them and put them away. This is the system, Andrew. And Obama literally almost began straight away in office, including pretty close to his first day in office, when he promised to close Guantanamo. Instead, it's not only open, but there's a string of torture prisons that operate around the world. I mean, we can keep this thing up. I mean, talk about a guy who literally is a despot, posing as a populist. I can't imagine why so many people absolutely don't understand what he's all about. In his most recent article, Paul Craig Roberts, who was on this program on Friday, his next to last line in his article was, "Thinking is an American disability."
Sadly, yes.
And if you add indifference to it, oh my goodness, it literally lets America get away with murder.
It does, but again, piggybacking on your comments, if you, again, look at what you've written about and what Obama said in his State of the Union, what I think your listeners are probably well aware of is that, you know, Obama the Democrat, like his Republican counterparts, have in their own different ways with not much variation, have been working for some time, and I feel they have been fairly successful in undermining the social welfare state by sapping it of funds. And in part, you see certainly the economic motivation, certainly they're pleasing their capitalist masters, but given that the country has been, and I still believe, in a very severe economic downturn, this is a way to redistribute monies upwards in this fiscal crisis and to give the top 1% more money to play with. And that's why Social Security, you're right, I agree, has been the what I would call the super prize, which the corporate elites have been away going after ever since the inception of Social Security back during the New Deal heyday.
Absolutely true. That is the grand prize, absolutely. Wall Street is dying to get its grubby hands on Social Security, privatizing it. But let me let you continue.
Sure. Now, again, with what we have been both discussing and taking us back to the State of the Union address, it's if you look a little deeply behind the abstract message, it's a really corporatist message. I feel in large part the State of the Union was who the audience was. It's the 1%. His reference to Medicare, his reference to expansion of the military, item by item. And again, if you consider this remark by Obama, which I took down verbatim, to me it was quite telling, where he says, "I'm proposing," and the key word here is partnership, "I'm proposing a partnership to rebuild America that attracts private capital to upgrade what our businesses must need." And there's additional part of that quote, but that's the essence. Now, again, translation, Obama is pretty clear whose interest he's serving, and that is of that 1% and of that capitalist class. Is that what is happening, and that's why the cuts to Medicare, the interest in going after Social Security, and other cuts, is that they want to take funds and all kinds of subsidies and tax breaks and projects and allow for corporate America to really expand their bottom line, which is profit maximization. And again, not to go off on a tangent, but this is pretty consistent. If you even consider what this administration has not done, considering which really should be considered as the criminal activity of banks, and that they essentially pilfered the public in what they did and made the economy go in a downturn. But not surprising, considering what, you know, Bill Clinton did, and 8 years later, we get the results of the elimination of Glass-Steagall. You remove all regulation on banks, you allow for speculation, and It's a Wild West. This is capitalism Wild West. And Obama is simply saying, hey, I'm on board with that. I'm going to help get monies to you to whatever it takes, and certainly if it means gutting any number of social programs, to give you the money that you need so you could maximize profits. But here is, again, what I call the underbelly of all this, which is, again, not stated in his State of the Union address, but there's one little thing he did say, which he did say, which kind of piqued my attention. He makes no mention that while all these monies are going to flow upwards, what we're continuing to see is the decline of the domestic economy. Certainly it's ongoing and it's diminishing industrial base with the exporting of jobs overseas as the corporate global hunt for cheap labor continues. And what's the evidence of this? Obama did make, to me, an interesting reference in his speech to what he referred to as negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is one of a number, without rattling them all off, of free trade deals, but this one with Asian nations. So here again, Obama is saying to his corporate partners that we're making now markets in another part of the world open for you so you can go and invest and hunt for cheap labor overseas. But what's left out of this picture are any agreements, Obama would never agree to this, which would support living wages for all workers around the globe, merely open up the markets and, well, you get your cheap labor and it is to the detriment of workers, so be it.
Indeed. Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are monster plans to create supranational power that overrides national sovereignty. That's what they're all about. And this TPP, Transatlantic Partnership, there's a complementary one with Europe that's that was proposed some months ago, it could have been a couple of years ago, but it's kicking in, and there were some major media reports on it, a transatlantic partnership, same kind of deal. But again, the idea is supranational power, where nations give up their sovereignty to this power, and literally legislatures have no authority to write their own laws, and the ones that are on the books, I guess, effectively go off the books, and Obama supports this kind of stuff.
Sure, and what we see is, and to me that's no coincidence, that's been the pattern for over 50 years. Prior to the corporations going somewhere, the military kind of appears before. And we see is the shift of military forces towards that part of the world to kind of say, here we are, you know, don't mess with the corporations. We want to create a rather peaceful climate for them to go about their business.
So they can go about their business of stealing our wealth and putting it in their own pockets. And indeed,
yeah,
accelerated
certainly.
Wealth transfer it to the top. Literally, I mean, the amount of wealth that is in the hands of the richest people in the country and of corporations that have amassed enormous amounts of cash, most of it secreted offshore in tax havens. The Federal Reserve keeps track of corporate cash, but I think only in America or in the form of securities, bonds, equities, other financial holdings that are basically U.S.-based, I believe, something to that effect. But there's so much money that gets stashed overseas, and I wrote an article about tax havens where nobody really knows how much money is in there, but numbers range up into the multi-trillions of dollars, 20 trillion, 30 trillion, and it doesn't even take into account lots of stuff you can't put a price on, things other than cash items, property, artwork, resources, I mean, all kinds of stuff that rich people own that nobody has put a price on. So, I mean, we're talking about enormous amounts of money, and the rich people don't pay taxes, and only the ordinary people, they want to pay taxes, and they'll barely get scathed. They'll get scathed a little bit, but there are so many loopholes in the tax law, Andrew, that whatever the increases in taxes are, clever lawyers and accountants will find ways around them. They always have, they always will. The rich people will get off pretty much scot-free, and ordinary people will pay the price. Well, they did with the payroll tax going up 2%. On average, that's $1,000 out of the income of the average income earner in America.
And you see, in connection with that, obviously no coincidence, there's little to no, in spite of the McCain-Feingold, there's no effort to reform campaign finance laws, because that's all tied into that, and as well as the legal support for them to do this through various Supreme Court rulings, the notorious one that they recently, now the name escapes me, in which they essentially said, well, just opened up your pocketbooks. But I am still convinced, in spite of everything we've been talking about and everything that we have talked about and probably will talk about in other programs, that I think there is some reasons to be cautiously optimistic, because here maybe I speak as with a bias of a political scientist who believes that there's only so much you could push. There's only so much you can oppress people that they're going to eventually rebel. We see this overseas. We see this in the Middle East, the ongoing Arab Spring, which to me offers an indication that the masses will, if they are pushed enough, are going to push back. What will happen in the United States, just off the top of my head, I wouldn't dare predict, but sometimes what is going on overseas does tend to ripple and have an influence at home as well as vice versa. So I say keep an eye on what's going on overseas, and certainly even progressive movements in Latin America, which is what the U.S. is also has great interest in what's going on over there, is reason to express some kind of cautious optimism.
There always is reason for cautious optimism, Andrew. And I just want to alert you that we've got a couple of minutes left, and I want to give it to you. But I always say, and I absolutely believe it, that the last line of defense is hope. If you lose hope, you lose everything. I never lose hope. And it's amazing what ordinary people can do when they decide they want to do it. They have power. The issue is using it. I don't mean by bomb throwing. I mean by mass organizing and so on. But let me give you the final thoughts. When the music begins, I have to sign off.
Sure. I just want to again say to your listeners that one must, if sounds like a rather cliche expression to summarize political events, but in politics, always expect the unexpected. That who would have thought of the Arab Spring? Who would have thought of those massive demonstrations? Who would have thought Mubarak would have been dethroned? Who would have thought it would have spread to the Middle East? Who would have thought that there is the growth of progressive movements in Europe across the board? There is resistance to the dismantling of the social welfare state in Europe. And who would have thought of an Occupy movement, which is still alive and well, even though the corporate media isn't covering it, and they are developing strategies, as any political movement does, and reassesses mistakes and has setbacks and moves forward. But I do have great hope with the young generation that they do have the opportunity, and I think some of them are going to exercise the opportunity as they raise their political consciousness and challenge the system as it is.
It's what we have to do, Andrew. And again, I don't mean by bomb throwing, but throughout history, including in America, there have been social movements at times, and wonderful changes came about. If it happened before, it can happen again. And really, I mean, ordinary people comprise the real superpower. They have to know it. They have to realize how greatly they've been harmed. And it's up to them on their own from the grassroots to do something to change things. It'll never happen at the ballot box. There's no difference between the two major parties. Andrew, we are out of time. I've got to wrap up. It was a wonderful hour.
I look forward to being on your program again.
Oh, I look forward to getting you back. This is important stuff. We're going to do another round. I promise you that. We'll get you back. We'll do more of this. And you focus on such an important topic and related issues. We absolutely will do it again. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks. I'll see you. Bye.
And I'll just remind listeners, tune in on Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.